World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. Still on the North African campaign, the story now of Vivian Dennis Samuel, who served as a tank commander in the British Army, first with the City of London Yeomanry and later with the Royal Tank Corps. He was awarded the Military Medal. At his home in Blackwood in the Adelaide Hills, he has a letter signed by King George VI attesting to his courage under fire. Viv Samuel has ventured far. Born in London to Lionel Horace Samuel and Miriam Silver, could I ask for a start, they're very Jewish names.
Yeah, well, there's a mixture of Jewish and Irish, but the name is Jewish, yes.
I wondered that because did this influence your decisions at all in terms of enlisting for war service?
No. I wanted to be a pilot in the RAF, and you could go for a five-year commission. At the end of that time, you came out with a gratuity of £5,000, which was quite a lot of money in those days. But my parents wouldn't agree, and under the age I was, they wouldn't agree to me going in, and I had to get their permission, you know, sign. Mm. So I thought, but they let me join the Territorial Army as a slight compensation for it. And so I thought, well, everything I learn in the Territorial Army is going to be useful later on when I do get in the RAF. So I joined the Territorial Army, County London Yeomanry.
What were their objections to the RAF?
They didn't want to get me killed. They didn't like me being a pilot. In those days, flying was still iffy.
So instead you did something very safe, like fighting in North Africa and Battle of El Alamein.
Yes,
I understand.
Right, yes.
Okay, but we were jumping ahead a bit. So growing up in London, and this
No, I didn't grow up in London. I was only about 3 years in London.
Yes.
So we moved to Canada because my father, who was English, but had been, when he left school, he went off to Canada just to bum around for a year. And while he was there, that's when the First World War started. So he thought, while he's in Canada, he might as well join the Canadian Army. So he joined the Canadian Army, I think, called Fort Garry Horse, which is a cavalry regiment, and then fought in France for 4 years and so on, and got wounded a couple of times, I think, and that married my mother and so on. And then after the war, the Canadian government had a similar scheme to the Australian government, a soldier settlement scheme, in which you got 640 acres, one square mile. So we went to Manitoba, roughly about 100 miles north of Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And there my father had built a log cabin. And my mother and I, and my sister by that time, went out to it, and I lived in Canada till I was about 12.
So you have clear recollections of life in Canada, in the log cabin?
Not all that much, but I remember quite a few incidents and things like that and so on. I remember seeing some Indians go by with two of them with a pole between their shoulders and a deer hanging by its feet. And another time we had garter snakes all round the house. I remember a snake getting into the log cabin one time, and my father was out. I've got a photograph of him out. He was with a team. He had a team of four horses for ploughing, and he wasn't in the place. So there was my mother and me and my baby sister, and I was about five by the six. and the snake had got in and was all over the, and my mother was practically having hysterics. So I managed with a broom to jam it up against one wall.
You went to school for a while in Canada and then back to London.
Yes, my father decided he wasn't a farmer after all, and my mother didn't like living in a log cabin in Canada, and she had a lot of influence, or her family had a fair amount of influence in the film industry, and his father's too, and so they got him a job. If they weren't back there, he could go into the film industry in England. So we went back when I was about 12, and I went to school for a few months at a primary school, elementary school, and then won a scholarship and went to the grammar school. And at the end of my parents wanted me to go on to university and be a doctor, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be an RAF pilot. So then I got my matriculation and so on, and then in the meantime I joined the Boy Scouts, and the school had a scout troop, and we used to go all over the place, including France and so on. You know, I remember camping in the Vosges Mountains one time.
But you joined the Territorial Army?
I joined it when I was about 18, yes.
Which is the British equivalent of the reserve, which
yes,
you might call
yes,
it here.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you joined a pretty significant, a famous regiment.
Yes, the County London Yeoman, you had to be, it was a bit exclusive, you know, you had to be careful about various things, and you had to speak with the right sort of accent. You had to play rugby, not soccer. Soccer was. and it was rather like that sort of thing. Yeah.
So it was the County of London Yeomanry.
Yes.
In which you learned to drive. You drove an armoured car, but not an ordinary
yes.
armoured car.
Yeah, no, it was a Rolls Royce. Well, they were all ordinary armoured cars, but they were all Rolls Royces and Daimlers brought back from the Northwest Frontier and the First World War and so on. So, and then I could tell you about a wonderful. I don't really want all this on tape, but it's a long story about a wonderful chap we had. The colonel, realizing after a while that the war looked imminent, thought it was about time all these mother's darlings were licked in properly into shape. So he got his regimental sergeant major from his old regiment, who had just retired from the army. He started as a drummer boy and worked his way up, and then before he retired, he was a regimental sergeant major, one of the senior ones in the army. He got him to drill us in, and he used to drill us. I remember one time in his armored car, he was talking to us about armored cars. He said, "Oh, it's nice." He was a real gold blimey Cockney, and he said, "Oh, it's nice having go around in an armored car. You see, you go through all the little towns and villages, and all the girls wave to you and your wife back, and then after a while, the car commander says, hands around the cigarettes. And you all have a fag, you know, and the driver's sitting there with his fag in his mouth, and suddenly a bit of the ash blows in his eye, and the next minute you're in the ditch. There will be no smoking in armoured cars." He was like that.
Lovely stuff. But there was war, and there was serious stuff to be done, and so you were sent on active service overseas. Where did you go to first?
We went right round the Cape. I could tell you about the trip round the Cape.
Go on.
I'm not going on too long.
I'm fascinated. You tell the story so well.
All right. Well, we were all on troop ships, the whole of the division, and I think what I was on was the Strathnava, and alongside us was the Strathaird and the Orion, all with men on board, all about 5,000 men each, though they were only supposed to hold about 1,500, but they were packed tight. We slept on the three on top of one another. One lot slept on the floor, the next lot slept on the top of the dining tables, and the next stop were sung by hammocks from the ceiling. So, and we had various destroyers and battleships and things to accompany us, and a lot of freighters carrying our tanks and trucks. And we were allowed on deck each day up from the hold where we lived. And we got up one morning, to avoid the enemy submarines, we had to, every 8 or every 10 minutes, they zigged and zagged all the way, zigzag. And I got up one morning, and there was the Orion. All the ships were... There was the Orion on our starboard side, with a... And the bows went down, straight down for about 8 or 10 feet, and then back for about 8 feet, then down to the waterline. And apparently what had happened, one of the battleships, I think it was the Queen Mary, instead of zigging, had zagged. Or hadn't done anything anyway. She went across the Orion's bow, who hit her square on. And no one was hurt. Yeah. Anyway, we got round to, went round the Cape, stopped at Cape Town for quite a long time, but to mend the Orion. We weren't supposed to. Only supposed to stop there just to refuel. But we were there for about a week and had a wonderful time, because all the South Africans took us to heart and took us all over the place and showed us the place and trying to get us into. They were rather keen on us coming back to the country after the war. I remember one of them asked me. I thought, well, no. By the time this war's over, I'm going to have had enough fighting and discord and so on. I don't want to come to a country that's going to have a party and all that sort of thing.
There was fighting to be done indeed. And you were in action against the Italians.
Yes.
At the Battle of El Gubbio.
El Gubbio, the first one.
Now, the Italians are often derided, but in fact they put on a most impressive show, I believe, at El Gubbio.
Yeah, they were. There's one division that was very good. Some of the Italian divisions were not much good. But that's because their heart wasn't in it. They weren't fascists. It was Mussolini's war. It wasn't their war. I think it was the Arietti division, who were all fascists. Their heart was in it, and they were as good as anybody else. So that's the reason. That's the reason I think the Italians gave in. They didn't care. They didn't. Wasn't their war.
I understand that. The expression used was the Italians won some respect, self-respect, in the Battle of El Gubbio.
Yeah, probably. They were. We beat them there. Of course, we knocked a lot of them out. But my own tank commander, I was a wireless operator in a tank, and a chap called Major Nichols. He got shot in the head.
Now, this was an occupational hazard, wasn't it, for tank commanders?
Yeah. That's why promotion in the... Once you got into action, promotion was fairly rapid in a tank regiment, because all the tank commanders were officers or NCOs, and they had to have their head out because the periscopes we had on these tanks were useless. Absolutely. Couldn't see a thing with them. So they got a much higher percentage of them killed or badly wounded in the head.
Well, there was something I understand that was particularly hairy, and you had to drive your tank out in reverse as the guns were knocked out.
That was up fairly later. This is when, by the time we'd gone back and forth a couple of times, Alam Halfa, my previous tank had been knocked out. Previous to that, I'd become a tank commander, but my tank had knocked out. We didn't have enough time, so I went back as being the wireless operator on the squadron leader's tank, a chap called Major Aird, Ronnie Aird, our squadron took on what seemed to be the whole of the German army coming out, the whole of the German tank force, and we got all our tanks were hit and so on, and we did quite a lot of damage. The end of it, we killed, knocked a lot of their tanks out, but there was still more than we had. And our tank was, both guns in the front were shattered, and the driver was killed because the shot, some of the had come through his driver's slit and hit him in the head, killed him. And so we... And the sort of tanks we had we couldn't go hull down because most of the tank was exposed. You couldn't get behind a hill completely because the main gun was in low down in the tank on the right hand side. That was a 75mm. But anyway, I was very small and very agile then, I managed somehow to get out of the turret and into the along inside the tank, and got sat up more or less on the driver's lap, the dead driver's lap, and drove us out. And I've got a little. I'll show you a thing in my book I've got about the regiment, and which Major Aird mentions it.
Thank you. And you yourself were wounded round about this time as well in the shoulder.
I've been wounded a bit earlier than that. that was a city Rizaik.
Yes.
And we were had not been knocked out of the tank. You know, the tank was set on fire and so on. And I was running around and being wherever, along with a lot of others. We were all surrounded by a lot of big German tanks, and they were much better than we were. The tanks were much better than ours, shall I say. And so it went.
So but,
I was on the back of a tank when, hoping to get rescued. And a whole lot of us clinging to the side and back of the tank, and there was someone shooting us. They were all bombarding us, and suddenly I felt a tremendous wallop on my shoulder, back of my shoulder, and then after a while, it didn't actually hurt very much, but it was like a big blow anyway. And then I could feel the blood running down, and so I managed to crawl somehow from the side of the tank onto the back, where I was flat back and lie there with my hair over the head over the air vents. It was sucking, blowing a bit of air on me, or sucking air into me, and eventually finished up at a casualty clearing station.
You gestured this then with your right hand, you pointed to your left shoulder. You've still got some stuff in there, haven't you?
Yes, only one lump.
You don't set off security alarms and things like that, do you?
I did once.
Did you?
Yeah, but now I always mention it beforehand. And the same when I have, several times when I've had to go to hospitals and various other things, and they want to x-ray me, and the first thing they say is, oh, you know you've got a foreign body in your chest. They're more interested in that than anything.
Now, I've got a photograph here from those times. I wonder whether you could just tell me what I'm looking at. I can see a group of men crouching down. It's obviously, it's North Africa.
Oh, it's more, it's morning.
Yes.
Early morning, and you... As Australians know, sometimes the early morning on a desert can be very cold. Mm. So there we're having an early brew up. And that's me. And that's the Major Air, the tank
yes.
commander.
But there was another battle after Sidi Rizaik, and it was El Alamein.
Yes.
Now, tell me.
All right.
What was it like?
We were in this. My division was the 7th Armoured Division. The original desert rats, not the Tobruk rats, but the desert rats. We've got an insignia on the shoulder that shows the Kawari. Kawari is a desert rat. It's an actual rat.
Can you spell it?
I've got a photograph somewhere of it. I'll show you in a minute.
How do you spell that, Kawari?
Kowari.
Thank you.
I think.
That's all right. It'll do.
Yeah.
And so El Alamein.
That was at El Alamein, right. We were in the south of the line. And the idea was to make the enemy think the main thrust was going to come there. So we, for us, the new division just come up from England, the 50th Northumberland Division, and we'd been nearly a year or two on the desert by then. We were used to it, but this was going to be their first action. So that's men of the 50th Division.
So we're looking at another photograph here, and men in tin hats and bayonets fixed. Advancing.
Yeah, that's the 50th Division going in, the first action.
Yes.
Anyway, the tremendous, as everyone knows, there was a tremendous artillery barrage, and then the enemy replied not quite so well, but...
And so, describe El Alamein to me. What images do you see when you conjure up memories of El Alamein today?
The tremendous artillery barrage, and then the engineers trying to get through the minefields, because we couldn't get, there were mines everywhere all along. The Germans, we'd laid mines, but the Germans had as well on the other side. And by that time I was commanding a tank as a corporal, and there was suddenly a pounding on the side door of the tank. Let me in, let me in. I thought, what? Someone must have been wounded. Thinking it was someone from the 50th Division. This is their first action. And one poor chap, all the noise and the artillery and the shells going off around him, he lost his nerve completely. And he ran away. And was banging on a tank to be let in. So helped him get up and get in. And there's no room in a tank for the normal crew. So an extra man in there was terrible. And he was sobbing and crying and everything else and so on. And we couldn't calm him down. So I said, look, you've got to go. Well, you've got to go back to the people behind. You're no good staying here. You can't stay here. So I got the gunner. We weren't actually in any action at the time. See, we were just waiting to go in, so I got the gunner to get out, and somehow or other we managed to get this poor chap out too. He tried to cling on to things and so on, but anyway, and the gunner took him back. And now, in the First World War, he'd probably be shot for desertion. Yeah. So now he'd be under post-traumatic stress. But in those days, it was... I don't know.
Anyway. So you told me that you were a corporal and tank commander, but I understand you lost rank for a while. There was an unfortunate incident.
After we broke through at Alamein for a while, I got jaundice, hepatitis these days. Anyway, it was I felt absolutely terrible with it. Really was really sick. It was common in the regiment by then, and we had one of the things too. We had terrible desert sores and things like that. But the jaundice had turned my everything yellow. I was going yellow. And then urine was incredibly yellow, and finally I was hopeless. I didn't care who won the war by then. I felt terrible, and especially tank commander. Anyway, they got me to a casualty clearing station place. The crew did got me out there and so on, and the New Zealanders, this New Zealand medical unit had just arrived in the desert. And the doctor said, I'm not quite sure what's the matter. I said, I know what it is. I've got jaundice. Everyone's got jaundice. So anyway, I went, they sent me back to Cairo, and I was there for about a week and so on, and I was, meanwhile, I know the regiment had gone on and on and on, and though they were held up a lot by the rain, because there had been very heavy rains just after El Alamein, and the Germans, as they went, as they retreated, once they found they weren't doing very well, they retreated, and they could retreat along the road, but we couldn't follow them along the road because they blew it up and mined it all over the long. So we had to try and go across the desert, and of course, not only did the tanks managed going through all this slushy, really heavy rain, it makes the desert very difficult to go through because the trucks couldn't get through. And we needed the trucks because they had our petrol on and ammunition and everything else and so on. So a lot of the German army got away. But a lot didn't, of course. There's some photographs you've got somewhere of prisoners coming in, hundreds of them.
There's great lines of them. But you were in hospital?
Oh, yeah, I was in hospital. And then what happened was I wanted to get out and go and get back to my regiment. And they said, no, you have to wait and go through all the proper procedures. So I thought, well, bugger that. So I nipped out one day and got a lift in a chap who was going up to the desert in his truck. And finally got up, found out where my regiment was after a while, about 1,000 miles west of there by then. And when I got there, reported, and my Major Ayres, the squadron leader, said, "Ah, welcome back, Corporal Samuel, welcome back." He said, "You're under arrest." and he said, "For desertion or absent without leave."
Because you discharged yourself from the hospital.
I discharged myself, yeah. And so he said, for one day, my punishment, I was stripped of being a corporal, went back to being a trooper, and the next day I was promoted again. So that was that little episode.
So, El Alamein over for the moment. The 7th Armoured Division follows the retreating Germans to Tripoli, which fell in January 43. But you saw further action in Tunisia against the German army, and you were awarded the military medal for bravery in action in the face of enemy fire. And your recollections are remarkably vivid, but I understand at the time you weren't quite sure why you'd been awarded the military medal.
I wasn't sure at all. Much to my surprise, I found out afterwards that I'd been given it when I got a letter from the divisional colonel, general rather, and saying I had and congratulating me on it, and I thought, what the hell? I didn't know anything about it.
Well, fortunately, we've got it here, and it says that on the 6th of April 1943, the squadron was holding a bridgehead, and enemy resistance was very fierce. Corporal Samuel quickly spotted one enemy gun position, which was causing our infantry and tanks considerable damage, and this he fearlessly engaged. He knocked out two large anti-tank guns, and when his ammunition was exhausted, he got out of his tank, in spite of heavy shell fire, to collect more rounds from another tank, which was out of action. And an immediate military medal was awarded, I understand.
I gather so, but I got a thing later, very much later, from the king, saying he was sorry he couldn't hand it to me personally, but there it is.
I've just been handed this sheet, Buckingham Palace notepaper, signed George R.I. I greatly regret that I'm unable to give you personally the award which you have so well earned. I now send it to you with my congratulations and my best wishes for your future happiness. What a superb memento!
While we were doing all this fighting there, the First Army and the Americans landed at the other corner of North Africa, and they were having a bit of a trouble. They were all raw troops. They hadn't been in action much or anything else and so on, and they didn't realize the Germans were as good as they were. Uh-huh. And so they were... the side of the fighting was over on our side anyway, so they moved my division and the 4th Indian Division by road. It was about 200 or 300 miles by a mountain road onto the First Army front in Tunisia, and it was the all our tanks were on transporters and so on, and we were going down one steep mountain road on this tank. My tank was on the transporter, and we're going faster and faster and faster. I thought, what the hell's going on, you know? And then I realized the driver apparently thought he'd coast down, save petrol, because it was a bit short. And so he hadn't put it in gear, and then he couldn't get it into gear. So he had, and then the tremendous weight of the tank on the back of the transporter, and the brakes weren't working properly, you know. Finally we got to the bottom where there was a curve, and off we went, crashed over, and one of my crew who was inside the tank at the time was killed. The rest of us were on the outside. We'd been sitting on the outside enjoying the air and so on, clinging like mad when it got faster. We were flung off. And none of us were hurt very much, or minor injuries and things. But my wireless operator inside was killed when the thing crashed over and so on. So that was the sort of thing that could happen. Indeed. But anyway, I went on. By that time, we then took on the Germans at various places and so on, where the Americans had been held up because they weren't expecting the Germans to be as good as they were, and we knew them. So the Americans were rather not too good.
But further recognition of your attributes came, and you were commissioned, Viv.
Yeah, well, what, as I said, tank commanders were very precious. So by that time we'd lost quite a few officers in the final attacks on Tunis, and so I was sent off to be commissioned. And while I was being back in the Middle East at Cairo and in Palestine, and my County of London Yeomanry Regiment was sent home to prepare for the Second Front. So after I was commissioned, I was sent to a different regiment, Second Royal Tank Regiment. And, I could tell you, do you want a little side story?
Interested in your side stories always.
All right. When we'd finished the... there's a picture there of me being... this cadet...
There you are.
Now I'm shaking hands with the general in charge. I think it's Alexander, isn't it? And that photograph, yeah.
Yes.
And anyway, I got ducks of my class there and sort of the thing, because most of them had come from fighting regiments or anything there, and they weren't used to all the sort of discipline and everything else that I'd been in, and all the troubles and so on. So, anyway, at the end of the course, and after we were commissioned, one chap said, "We ought to have a dance or something to celebrate." And another chap said, "What about girls?" And another chap said, "I know there are about 30 English girls living on a house." Went along with him to drum up the opposition for the dance, and that's where I met my wife, Lorna.
Lovely story.
Yeah, she was a code and cipher operator working with SOE.
Oh, yes.
Which is Special Operations Executive, yeah. And they were on shift work, and in touch with our agents behind the lines in Italy and Greece and Yugoslavia and so on. The ones in France, agents in France and Germany, so they were done from England, but the ones nearer Cairo were done from Cairo. So that's where I met Lorna, and we got married just after the war.
Very glad you told me that story. The war still had to be won, though.
I've got a photograph of myself and on her houseboat somewhere, probably in that other envelope.
We've got some wonderful photographs here of North Africa
back at the end of it.
A number of rich illustrations, memorabilia. We'll find it in a moment.
Yeah.
Let's just go back to the war for the moment, though, because after being commissioned, You served in the push through Austria in 1945.
Well, I went right up through Italy.
Yes.
We started in the bottom of Italy and went right up. It was... Now, that's when I was in Rome. You can see the kawari on my shoulder.
I'm looking at another photograph here of you with your kawari on the shoulder, that's right, and you're a lieutenant by this time.
Yes.
Okay. So you fought your way up through the Italian campaign, Sicily, then Austria, and the idea in a hurry.
Before the Russians. Mm. By that time, the war had... finished, and I spent the D-Day, this is the war in Europe had finished, yes. The war hadn't in Japan, we spent D-Day repairing our, not repairing our tanks, but taking the tracks off our tanks and putting rubber shod tracks on, because we had hundreds of miles of road to transfer us, and the steel tracks would ruin the road. So we had spent D-Day, well, the rest of the army were getting drunk. We were working at changing the tracks on the tank. We'd also taken the, we'd had to take, up till then, we'd had attached lengths of angle iron, about 6 inches of angle iron each side onto the track to make the tracks wider. Yes. So we had to take them all off because we wouldn't be able to get across the bridges with the extra width of the thing. So we spent the whole of that day working hard.
Away then, from work, though, you mentioned that you'd met Lorna when she was working as a cipher operator for SOE.
Codes and cipher.
And when did you get married then? I've got a lovely photograph of the two of you. Trees in the background. I can't
That's on the houseboat she was on.
That's on the houseboat sedan,
which was attached to the moored by the Kazira Sporting Club in Cairo.
Lovely.
And I still was on a bit of leave. I went there with her and played tennis, and it was one of those clubs that was for the English in Cairo, or if you were French, you could join. About a year after the war, I got back to England and we got married then.
Well, war's over, you go back to London, which would have had a terrible pummeling while you'd been away.
Yeah,
what were your impressions when you got there?
Well, my impressions of London, or England, were rather horrible. When we finally got back, the troop ship thing that took us there got us into, I think it was to New Haven, and they found that the railway was on strike. We couldn't get to London. There was a strike on. And so one of the men on board with us had been an engine driver. And so we drove to London. I was sent up to Catterick in Yorkshire to be reposted somewhere else, probably to an army of occupation in Germany. But the major who was doing the posting when I saw him, we knew one another. He'd been with the our reconnaissance unit in the desert, and we knew where. He said, he said, "Where do you want to go?" I said, "Well, I've just got married in London. I'd like to go back to London." And he said, "Well, I haven't got any postings in London at the moment." He said, "But go and leave and I'll see what I can do." The whole thing, the thing is, the Eighth Army was run on the old boy basis. If you knew someone, that was it. Anyway, so I went back to London on leave again, signed by him. And then a few days later, I got a telegram thing from him saying that I'd been posted as the adjutant at a prisoner of war camp in Cambridgeshire. So I went to this prisoner of war camp. It was German prisoners, all Germans in there. And, of course, the war was over. They weren't giving any trouble. All they wanted to do was get back to Germany. And I don't like to... sounds make it sound too bad, but the other officers, the other officers in that unit, the prisoner of war camp, hated me because I was the only one who'd been in action, and so on. They were all rejects from their regiments for some reason or other. They hadn't taken part in any of the fighting and so on. They were just sent to that prisoner of war camp, and the guards were all deaf, dumb, lame, blind, pioneer corps, you know, hadn't been, and the only ones I got along very well with were the office staff, and they were all conscientious objectors, so they'd been sent there instead of fighting. And the colonel, I'm sure several of the officers were used to flog things off on the black market, some of the food and some of the petrol and all that sort of thing, and the colonel used to was absolutely useless. You know, I think he'd been lieutenant colonel he was, but somehow he got there, I think, just before the war, he reached that rank, and he still had the same rank after the war. So just how, he used to sign everything, would put in front of him. As the adjutant, I'd get things and put in front of him, and he'd sign them without looking at them or anything else. And one of the things that came was they wanted people to be sent to a special school to be trained back into Civvy Street, you know. And I've got there's a paper about it somewhere, possibly in there, yeah. And so I put my name down, put it in front of him, he signed it, whatever. And a few days later, I was posted to this thing. He said, "What the hell's this?" I said, "Well, you signed it, sir, you know." He hadn't read it. So I was sent to this for a three-month course on getting back to Civvy Street. And at the end of that course, I got on a further course with a company called the Wayne Tank and Pump Company, making petrol pumps. There were five trainees, all ex-officers from the various services, some couple from the Army, couple from the Air Force, one from the Navy. We all became very great friends. And we were put through all the different departments, one at a time, you know, in different departments. So I spent a few months with the fitters, out in the cold, fitting things up and so on. A few months on the production line, a few months with the sales department, a few months with the export department, and so on and so forth. And I finished up at the end of the training as the personal assistant to the managing director, which meant I had to see all the people he didn't want to see and go to the lunches he didn't want to go to and things like that. So Bill Quill, who was the managing director of Kelvinators of Australia, was there, and they made our petrol pumps under license here in Australia. And my managing director said to Bill Quill, "Oh, Viv would like to go to Australia, wouldn't you, Viv?" And I'd been whinging about the weather in Australia, and Bill Quill said, "Well, any time you'd like to come, I'll give you a job." So I went back and told my wife, Lauren. She said, "Well, take him up on it," because she too had spent a few years in Cairo, you know, in the Middle East and so on, a little warmer weather. So I did, and so that's how I got in touch with him, and he got me to go. Actually, sent me off to Scotland to find it, do some work for him up in Dundee before I came back to England, before I went over to Australia. So when I got here, and they put us up in it. Kelvinators had a house which they made into three separate habitations at St. Peter's, you know, Paynham, you know. And so they put us up there for most of a year. By that time, we'd had a little girl. She was about three and a half. So we came to Australia. I was with Kelvinators for a time, but unfortunately, Bill Quill died about a few days before I got to the firm. And new managing director, I can't remember his name, Sir somebody or other, came over from Chrysler and took charge of Kelvinators. And whereas Bill Quill's idea had been to make the pumps a completely separate part of the organisation, the new chap said, no, it's just another refrigerator, so the job I'd come for fell through. I mean, they gave me another job there and so on, but and then I got a job as forgotten the name of the firm. Urethane Foam Company. Mm. Yeah, making polyurethane foam.
Right.
Managing director of this urethane, and went all over the place and so on, and I was making the foam, making foam pulling the triggers and something, you know, and it all sprayed out the but it wasn't it. I spent about 3 months, for instance, up at in Queensland, just near, I've got the name of the place, near Brisbane, spraying all the walls of a refrigeration company, refrigerated meat, things like that. And anyway, then I got fed up with that because it wasn't doing my health any good. The urethane foam, even though you wore a mask, you got a lot of fumes, and it was making me cough a lot and so on. So I thought I'd better give that up, and I went back to the Wayne Tank Company, and became their sales manager. And then they opened a new branch, with methylene, which is a treatment of steel. So de-rusting steel and putting a coat of on it that makes it very easy to paint over and so on. So I used to travel around a bit and so on, met a lot of people.
Great honour speaking to you today. Thank you so much for being part of this project. It was very important to talk to you because we thought we'd talk to someone who didn't serve in the Australian forces but was an ally and had seen a lot of the Aussies. I hadn't asked you, what were your impressions? Did you come across the Australian forces at all, and what did you think of them?
Came across the Australians. One time when I got slightly wounded, I was sent to ended up in a hospital. I think it was an Australian hospital of some sort, a hospital unit anyway. And there were mostly Australians there, and of course they were from Sydney, and they all had strong Sydney accents, and all except for one chap. And I said, Jack something. I said, how is it that Jack doesn't speak like the rest of you? And my mother said, oh, he's a college boy, and not only that, comes from South Australia.